Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today on our show, we're going to talk about Alastair Sim, probably the quintessential Scrooge from A Christmas Carol. And I will say that my discovery of Alastair Sim was, of course, The Christmas Carol, and was impressed with his performance of it and, you know, the way he sort of became the role. And then for the show, I went and sort of backfilled on some of the other things that he has done and or had done, and, you know, found that he was actually a comedic actor, to my surprise. But Mike, I'm going to toss it to you to talk about maybe his earlier stuff and what you knew about him before Christmas Carol. And then we will talk about A Christmas Carol in depth.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the very nature of being a character actor. When we think about Hollywood in the studio era, I think in particular the 1930s and 1940s, what a glorious array, what a wealth of character actors. You know, they had to be good actors, but they needed distinctive physical features because sometimes they'd only appear in a few scenes, right? So they needed to make a strong visual impression that way. And sometimes they were living caricatures, and I mean that as a compliment. They embodied a certain character trait and they did it in movie after movie. Well, in England, if anything, they're even more blessed, always have been, with great character actors. And, you know, there's something distinctive about a voice or a physical feature, just the persona. And some of these actors will have starring roles, but oftentimes just, you know, they're featured players. Now, the actor we're talking about, Alastair Sim, certainly qualifies as a leading man. After all, in Christmas Carol, which we'll spend a lot of time talking about, he's Scrooge. I mean, there's your title character right there. And there are other movies he made in which he, you know, has a starring role, but oftentimes it's just that physical presence. And you're right, although he had some really strong dramatic roles, including in Christmas Carol, he was primarily known as a comic actor, a comedian. And in Scrooge, he gets to show that off towards the very end of the film when Scrooge has been redeemed and he's happy-go-lucky and bouncing around the room. And we'll get to that too. It's a glorious, a wonderful scene, isn't it? That's where you see the comic actor, the kind of shtick, if you almost like what we'd call vaudeville type routine, how happy he is bouncing around. But let's bounce back to his origins. When he's born in 1900, he has a rather protracted, a rather delayed entry into show business. He's Scottish. He goes to the Edinburgh University. He has an academic background, essentially. And in fact, he actually works as a professor. And guess what he's a professor of? Elocution. As if the Brits didn't already speak beautifully, right? He actually teaches, he made his living teaching elocution. The word itself even is so high tone. And, you know, joking aside on this, when you watch his movies, you would expect, being a Brit actor, he'd be well-spoken. But my goodness, his enunciation, his, you know, handling of the language is so sharp, so precise. So that's one thing that makes him notable, just by way of like a really formal training in how to speak. But what's, I think, even more striking is the fact that, as I mentioned, he has a rather protracted and delayed entry into show business. He doesn't make his first appearance as a stage actor until he's 30. That's late. He doesn't make his first movie until he's 35. That's really late. And then, alluding to what Marie mentioned before, it does make quite a few films, actually, as you get into the 1940s, and some of them are dramatic. I would recommend Waterloo Road from 1944. It's a film in which John Mills is the star, and Alastair Sim has a strong role as a doctor there. So he appeared in some of those British dramas of the 40s, but as often, he would appear in comedies, things like Hue and Cry from 1943 and so on, and you know, a number of films that would have been seen certainly by British audiences and only some of them by American, because after all, you know, we just get sort of the cream of the crop, or, you know, a selection of what people were watching back at home. So by the time he makes A Christmas Carol, and I should quickly put a footnote here, or an asterisk, if I can do that via Zoom, you know, an asterisk here, the fact that we know the film as A Christmas Carol, released in 1951. It was released under the title Scrooge in Great Britain. And I think one reason for that might be, and I'm speculating here, I'm just thinking that he was really well known to British audiences at that point. And he is, after all, playing Scrooge, and that close identification that way. If you're selling it to an American audience, you know, think, well, okay, you know, Christmas Carol, a story everyone knows, and they may or may not know him as an actor. Now, speaking of Christmas Carol as a property, there have been many versions of it going back to the silent film era. And maybe in a little while we can delve into some of that as to how why this version is considered the best of them all. But for the moment, let me just set the stage there that, you know, it's now 1951 and this film, Christmas Carol, is being made by a rather small film production company in Great Britain, Renowned Pictures, which is why it's actually released by United Artists. UA picked it up. It's one reason why this film was widely seen in the United States. You know, an American company, United Artists, picks up this British film and it gets a full American release and is very widely reviewed. And for the most part, positively. There's some odd, rather strange negative reviews of it, which we can delve into maybe. But for the most part, people realize from the start it's a really good film. So Murray, let me hand it back to you and you can start to tell us why it's a really good film.
Well, I'd sort of like to give a mention to some of the things he did leading up to that, just in passing for people who might want to look him up on Amazon Prime. He did a movie called Green for Danger in 1946, which you can also watch the entire thing for free on YouTube, where after a nurse who declares that a recent surgical death was a murder dies also, an enigmatic Scotland Yard inspector arrives to investigate, starring Alastair Sim. He also did The Bells of St. Trinian's in 54 and a whole Inspector Hornley series in 1939, which are very humorous. It's, you know, they investigate murders. It's a little bit of a Keystone Cops sort of a arrangement in each of the three movies. And he also made Stage Fright with Alfred Hitchcock, where a wonderful role for him because he's so engaging and likable. I also wanted to mention that I thought it was key that, you know, Charles Dickens died in 1870 and Alastair Sim was born, you know, only 30 years later. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. So he sort of embodies that sort of Dickensian character, doesn't he? Where he, you know, sort of shows characters who are, you know, eccentrics or rogues or, you know, pathological assassins. That's sort of his stock in trade. So by the time we get to A Christmas Carol, you know, he's already sort of established himself as, you know, the ultimate Dickens character. What do you think?
Well, yeah, let's amplify the filmography even more here because it's good. because we want to spend most of our time talking about Christmas Carol, but to get a sense of that overall career, you mentioned some of his most important films, and there are a few more to mention. One is An Inspector Calls from 1954. And the film that you mentioned, and I want to talk about for just a little bit more, is The Bells of St. Trinian's from 1954. The reason I want to dwell on it for just a minute or so is the fact that in the early 50s, the Brits made a lot of great comedies. And, you know, which Lavender Hill Mob, you know, films like that, which he actually was considered for when they were casting. For films like that, you know, and you have actors like Alec Guinness and so on with whom he worked. Great comedies. He's part of that movement in the 1950s in particular. And The Bells of St. Trinian's is one of the great examples of that kind of British comedy, because in that film, he has dual roles. He plays the headmistress of a girls' school. And the Brits, you know, going back to the music hall tradition and Christmas panto, meaning pantomime shows and all that, they love to dress up in drag. And if we were to explore that further, Dr. Freud would have to enter the room at some point. But you know what I'm getting at? That's just part of the Brit tradition is to, you know, put on a dress, put on a wig. He comes out of that sort of music hall element there. And Bells of St. Trinian's then, he's playing this sort of prim and proper headmistress of a girls' school, but it's a dual role. He's also playing that headmistress's twin brother, who's a bookie. So you get a kind of Jekyll and Hyde sort of formulation. And the only other thing I'll mention at the moment is it's so typical of Brit comedies at that time, not just with the dressing up, but the dual roles. Think about Alec Guinness. Think about other actors, you know, or later Peter Sellers, you know, actors who would take on multiple roles. And you see that versatility in performance, you know, that, you know, not just a comic actor, but the kinds of comedy. And Marie, you were alluding to this as well with Alastair Sim, again, with the kind of comedy he did, so much of it has to do with the physical appearance, the physical presence. With Alastair Sim, he has a really expressive face and he's got these headlight type eyes. They're just so big. I mean, you know, if you're a screen actor, that's a real virtue, right? To have eyes like that. He has basically Betty Davis eyes or something. And so whether he's playing comic or playing dramatic, they really serve him well. And as we start to get into Christmas Carol, what's striking about it is not only that it's a great dramatic performance, but there's a whole range of emotions, depending on where Scrooge is in his long night, if you will, when he plays, you know, stern and mean, when he plays scared, when he plays happy. And maybe at this point, then we can delve back into that film and really start to give a sense of why it's considered, you know, the best screen version of Christmas Carol. And there have been so many, which again, we can double back on in a bit.
You know, I wanted to share this this quote that he made about making films, which I think is sort of sets, you know, the idea of how he would approach the roles. He says, "At first, I wasn't sure if I liked films. The sequences are so disconnected and mechanical, I thought I should have difficulty getting into the skin of the characters. But I soon found that the care, precision, and concentrated energy that attends the photographing of each scene conspires to pitch one into the right frame of mind." So I would say that I feel like he approaches the Christmas Carol and just enters into the whole idea of Ebenezer Scrooge and really becomes that character.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a reminder too, again, he was a professor of elocution. He begins as a stage actor, segues into film. He's accustomed from stage training to doing things straight through. It is an adjustment to shoot scenes where you're shooting out a sequence. You're absolutely right. And, you know, watching the film, it's seamless. You know, that's a mark of a good film, right? You don't realize how it was cobbled together. But Marie, you make a good point about him there. And the fact that he could play so many aspects of Scrooge, and then in other films like St. Trinian's, play multiple roles, he has that switch inside him. And Peter Sellers would have it later, right? You hit the switch and you become, if not another character, at least another aspect of character. And again, that kind of physical shtick and vocal shtick is all important there. It's a reminder too that when Dickens first published A Christmas Carol, which was in 1843, it really is one of the building blocks of Christmas, essentially. In other words, our notions about Christmas are essentially Victorian. Even though some of the roots or origins of Christmas you can trace back hundreds of years in Germany and England and elsewhere, essentially the way we think of Christmas, the way it's trimmed, the Currier and Ives kind of sensibility in this country, that goes back to the mid-19th century, not much further back than that, really. And Dickens' Christmas Carol in 1843 was an enormous literary success. And this is serving our purposes at the moment, from when Dickens published it, I like to refer to it as either a very long short story or a very short novella. It's sort of in that mid-range there, you know, nomenclature. What is this beast? But anyway, Christmas Carol, when it came out, it was almost immediately adapted for the stage. So it has been known in other media almost from the get-go. And moreover, Charles Dickens, who loved to give public readings, was known actually well, until near the end of his life, as the late 1860s, when he was doing his public performances. And he was a performer, a bit of a ham at the lectern. When he was doing those, he loved to do a live reading of a sort of edited version of Christmas Carol. So imagine what a treat that would have been to have Charles Dickens himself at the lectern doing all those roles. I mean, you know, everything from Scrooge to Tiny Tim to Mrs. Cratchit, you know, and he would do the voices, you know, we've got written accounts of this, and he just loved to do that. So for someone like Alistair Sim, it's that kind of a really, really delightful challenge to take on this character who has so many aspects of character. Because he's not just the grouchy guy. When he revisits his early life and then towards the end of his long night, as I said earlier, you know, you see different aspects of him. So I'm gonna hand it back to you.
You know, I think it's important to mention that the Scrooge character was likely based on a real person. And this is also why I think it's such an enduring tale, because Scrooge is sort of an exaggeration of a lot of bad qualities. But you know people like this. You know people who are, everybody's met somebody who was, you know, considered to be stingy. But this man that they think it was based on was a person named John Meggett, who was a local celebrity, a member of Parliament, and a famous miser from Dickens' part of England. So, I mean, he was known for things like when he would set off for a journey, he'd fill his pockets with hard-boiled eggs so that he wouldn't have to pay for meals in taverns. And, you know, he rode in the soft dirt by the side of the road so that he wouldn't have to buy horseshoes for his horses. And he'd go hours out of his way to avoid toll rolls. And if he needed to stop for the night, he'd stop on the side of the road that had a lot of grass so, you know, the horse could eat for free. So he was sort of famous for being incredibly miserly and, you know, perhaps a model for the character that we know. So I think that is one of the things that Alistair Sim's lands with his portrayal that I think is a little lacking in Jim Carrey's, is the idea that, yes, this is an actual person, a real person who, you know, you can imagine knowing and who had become angry and bitter by his disappointments in the world.
One thing that's interesting when we talk about the role model there, there are so many illustrations of it, so many stories about this guy, right? How miserly he was. And they're all entertaining, right? But the thing is, one of the great hallmarks of the Dickens story is its relative brevity. Dickens has a clearly defined thesis, if you will, and scene by scene, there's not a wasted word. Think about that. In the Dickens story, everything locks into place neatly, and it works perfectly. I mean, Dickens, of course, was one of the great masters of a kind of prose narrative, but a lot of his novels, as you know, start to push the 1,000-page mark even. They really get up there, the other side of 500 pages. This is meant as a deliberately scaled down, really concise story. Now, where it serves our purposes for discussion right now is the fact that one of the many reasons why this is such a great version of A Christmas Carol cinematically is it has a really tight 86-minute running time. And if I seem obsessed with the running time of a film, there are other versions of Christmas Carol that run longer, but should they? In other words, when you watch this film, first of all, the dialogue is so familiar. It's like, you know, the adaptation for the screen is so adroitly done that, yes, all the famous lines are there. And I feel like, you know, it's almost like a viewer participant experience where I'm like almost ready to recite the dialogue along with the characters. I know it, right? We all know it. You know, you start to say it as they say it. But, you know, jesting aside there, it's just how astutely that's done. You really find yourself realizing this is a distillation of what's already a relatively short narrative. And it has all the key scenes and all the dialogue you need. And there's really not a wasted moment in it. There's only one or two things that they even added to it that aren't in the original story, which maybe we can mention, but the fact that it really moves ahead quite briskly. And I think what happens there is that you get totally caught up in it and you don't have the leisure time on screen to be distracted by something else or have the story meander somewhere else. Because when you mention the real life role model, there are what I would call almost like picaresque elements there of all the things this guy did here and there, whatever. No, Dickens gets it really down to the essence. And likewise, Alistair Sim, when you watch the aspects of Scrooge here, when he goes from one scene or one ghost, if you will, one spirit to another, it's handled in a matter of seconds. And, you know, I wasn't wearing a watch to clock everything, but, you know, never felt like, oh, geez, you could tighten that up by 5 seconds. No, it really moves quickly.
You know, I do want to mention, though, that although this movie is widely regarded as the best version of Dickens' story, it is the only one which omits Ebenezer Scrooge's famous line, "If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled in his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart." Now, Alistair Sim did eventually get to say it when he reprised his role in the animated Christmas Carol. But otherwise, it is probably one of the more faithful versions to the original story, even though it did take some liberties.
Well, you know, there's one scene that was added in the film. This is a really minor example to give because there are only minor examples of this. It's so faithful to the Dickens story that you're right, Marie. You can find some lines that, you know, maybe should have been in the film. And that one you cite it's a really striking line of dialogue. I'm not sure why that was omitted, honestly, as to why it was kept out. But the only scene that I know of off the top of the head that was totally added for the film reinforces thematically what's there. Remember in the film, if you haven't seen it for a while, there's a scene where, you know, I mean, Scrooge is always counting his money, right? He's always aware of everything that way. So he goes to a restaurant and he's at the table and he's having a meal, of course, by himself, which is, you know, the solitary nature of this guy, right? By himself. And the waiter comes over and Scrooge asks for, another piece of bread. And the waiter tells him, well, that'll be an extra whatever, you know, farthing, whatever the additional cost is. And without missing a beat, Scrooge says, oh, never mind, no more bread. And then the scene ends. Now that was added and I'm fine with it. It's a funny and very revealing scene and only lasts, a matter of what, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, whatever. But for whatever reason, that was actually added. And there are one or two little things like that. But for the most part, you could take pages. And speaking of pages of the book, I mean, I was about to say you take pages of the book and put them right on the screen. This movie opens like so many classic films derived from great literature have done. I mean, now we've sort of lost that tradition. But if you have a new movie coming out based on a famous novel, think back like to Hollywood days, 1930s, 1940s. You know, you're going to have the opening of the film be, you know, the bookshelf. And in this film, Christmas Carol, somebody takes, you know, the book off the shelf and opens it. And then the credits are actually printed, you know, like page by page there. And again, the brevity of it, within a matter of seconds, you're into the film, right? But that was that tradition of how you would have the actual book open up And it was a sense of high-mindedness, if you will. And I mean this in a complimentary way. Here's a great work of literature. Now here's the screen version. Yeah, it can be kind of stuffy or certainly a kind of knee-jerk conventional thing to do, but it works here, doesn't it? Here's Dickens off the shelf and on the screen. And doubling back on what I was saying a moment ago, the fact that it really is the Dickens story. It's true to that book that you saw pulled off the shelf. And I rather like that as a way of getting into it.
Yeah, it gives you the feeling of, you know, curling up to with your family to read it every year as part of a Christmas tradition, which is kind of a nice way to frame it. By the way, I did want to mention that between 1941 and 1968, he played Captain Hook in at least six different stage productions of Peter Pan, which is just, of course he did, right? Because he would be a perfect Captain Hook. You had mentioned the silent film versions of A Christmas Carol, which I'm not really familiar with, but would you like to say something about that in terms of a comparison with, you know, this classic?
Well, the earliest one I'm aware of is from 1901. And of course, most films in that era, you know, it might just run 2 or 3 minutes, you know, at most. So in the really early versions of it, if this film that we're talking about from 1951 is clocks in at almost 90 minutes and has the essence of the story, some of those really early silent versions sort of give you the highlights of the highlights, if you will. You know, you're gonna have, you know, Scrooge being mean to Bob Cratchit, his loyal assistant. You're gonna have him go home. You'll have like just 2 or 3 scenes after that where he confronts each spirit, and then bam, within a matter of minutes, the film is over. There was a somewhat longer silent version, 1922. You do start to get feature length versions of them. There are at least 8 or almost, I would say more than that, versions that are feature length. The one I want to mention quickly though, Marie, is actually the most popular Hollywood version of the story. And the reason I want to mention it is this, it's a comparison contrast thing. Think of all the virtues of the film we're talking about, this version of it. In 1938, MGM did a version of Christmas Carol with Reginald Owen in it as the lead. And he's okay. I mean, it's an entertaining film. I'm not bad-mouthing it as a film, but I'll just bad-mouth it slightly then and say that it has all of the MGM polish and all the MGM production value and all the MGM sentimentality that you would expect from a Hollywood film in that era. And that actually, I think, works against it. It becomes kind of treacly, you know what I mean? It's just a little too sweet, and it's actually overproduced in some ways. MGM, you know, certainly knew how to turn on the production value, and there's just too much of it that way. And again, it's sort of a you know, full table, if you will. By that I mean, rather than just like, what are the dishes you need? What do you really need here? It's just like, well, let's do this, let's do that. It's Victorian era, so let's really, you know, lay it on, right? And so, you know, in terms of the costumes and the setting and all that, it becomes a bit too much that way. And the reason in particular, though, I'm mentioning it is, if you watch the 1938 Hollywood version, you think, okay, well, that's pretty good. I mean, it gets the story, but watch it next to this one. This one seems lean and mean by comparison, and that's a good thing. We should actually, at this point, talk a bit about the look of the film. You know, we've been talking about his characterization, and we'll say more, but let me hand it back to you at the moment, and we'll go back and forth if we can, just in terms of our impressions of how this film looks, the actual physical production.
Well, the actual physical production feels like you've opened up a Victorian storybook, and now you are walking around inside of it. It has a really lovely Dickens Christmas feel to it. And I think that kind of old-fashionedness is also part of Alastair Sim's appeal in this movie. I have an anecdote here about how during a break in the making of the film, he borrowed a fan magazine from another actor and flicked through it and was appalled by what he saw. So, you know, just even in terms of the movie starness of things, you know, he has that sort of British reserve, and that kind of comes across in the way the movie looks too, just the formality.
What I'm thinking about as well is the fact that, you know, I'm a big fan of black and white films. Yeah, call me old fashioned, if you will, but the black and white cinematography works really well for this one because it gives you a sense of vignette, you know, revisiting the Victorian era as you might see it in an old photograph, or you might, you know, the black and white of reading a page even, right? It has that kind of sensibility to it. The film itself was shot partly on location. There are some streets and buildings that have been identified as where they actually shot parts of it. So it actually is Victorian London in places. They found some streets in downtown London that are still essentially Dickensian. So some of the street scenes are studio work and some of them are, you know, actual locations. But even those that are obviously studio work still for me work, they have a kind of charming storybook quality. as if you were walking into a Currier and Ives engraving, to use a kind of American reference that way, or just simply, you know, the illuminated shop fronts and all. You walk along the street and you see all the shop windows filled with dolls and toys and this and that. And there's some scenes that really play that up, actually more so even than Dickens' novella would have played that up. But that black and white cinematography, particularly early in the film, Scrooge really is mean. You know, nothing is really done here to temper that. Say, oh, but he's really a softy at heart. No, it doesn't tip you off that way. He's really mean. And we could give all sorts of examples from the first third of the film of how mean he is. And the thing is, when he goes home, and of course he lives by himself, I mean, he's got the maid who comes in, and of course he berates her just as he does Bob Cratchit. Nobody gets off with Scrooge. But when he gets home, inside the house, I thought I was watching a German expressionist film for a while. You know what I mean? It's black and white cinematography, sharp contrasts of black and white, partly in him and in Alistair Sim's, you know, a very pasty white face, right? But, you know, also dark clothes around that kind of contrast, but also within the house itself, there are very long shadows here. And in reading about this film and, you know, watching documentaries about it, there was one short documentary I watched about this film that made me laugh out loud. They had a still photo from Christmas Carol, Alistair Sim as Scrooge, when Scrooge is really looking nasty, right? And right next to it, they put an image of Werner Krauss, who plays Caligari in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1919, the great German expression. They look like they're separated at birth, you know? These two belong side by side. And then within his house, you know, when he walks up and it's very much a Victorian house, when he's walking up the gloomy staircase, it's such a long staircase. You would think you were in a subway station or something, like, you know, moving up to the second floor, the long shadows cast by him against the wall, you're getting into like monster movie territory, right? In fact, in one of the documentary interviews that I was watching, a critic made a very funny observation. He thought he was watching Psycho for a moment. He thought this was the Victorian staircase inside the house in Psycho. And so it works extremely well here, because it really gives an ominous, really a sense of foreboding. This man has had a miserable, lonely life, and there's a menace to him. So he really seems not only unsympathetic at the start, but he almost seems monstrous that way. So he's actually more frightening, ironically, than spirits. When they start appearing to him, I mean, they can give you the shakes too, but Scrooge is the one who really makes you shake.
Right, all those spirits slunk off, you know, afraid of him. That's what really happened, the alternative version. Thanks for using that term, casting a long shadow, because I think that sums up our featured actor today. All the way to, you know, current day depictions of characters like Scrooge McDuck. So I want to leave our listeners with a final quote from Alistair Sim, where he says, "It was revealed to me many years ago with conclusive certainty that I was a fool, and that I had always been a fool. Since then, I have been as happy as a man has a right to be," which sounds just like something you'd hear from Ebenezer Scrooge after he had come to the realization. And that wraps up our show about Alistair Sim. Join us next week for another topic. And don't forget to check out our podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then, and have a good holiday.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.